Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we're continuing our series on John Steinbeck. This year, we've been reading through all of Steinbeck's major works. We started with Pastures of Heaven, and this is the second book in the series, To a God Unknown. We will be doing two podcast episodes on this book for a couple different reasons. First amongst those, it's probably the most strange, confusing, explorational of Steinbeck's works. I wanted to get a few different perspectives on the meaning of this work, the characters, the plot, the context, and some of the major themes. Our first guest is Dr. Daniel Rivers. Dr. Rivers is an associate professor of American Studies and Literature at San Jose State University, and Dr. Rivers also is the director of the Martha Heasley Cox Center for Steinbeck Studies at San Jose State University. We had a great conversation. We talked about a lot of things, including Dr. Rivers' own research and writing on this book. There's a lot to learn from this conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it. Dr. Rivers, I want to start with an easy question. What's your favorite Steinbeck novel, and then which one do you think is most underrated critically?
Oh, goodness. That is not an easy question. I do think To a God Unknown is my favorite Steinbeck novel. I feel this way. I feel in some ways the same way I feel about Steinbeck that I feel about like James Baldwin. They don't all have to be technically perfect to be some of my favorites. And in fact, some of my favorites are the less popular or less, I don't know, some of the ones where you kick the tires and maybe it needs a little air. So To a God Unknown is probably my favorite. I think maybe a close second is probably In Dubious Battle.
Okay. Another one I haven't read. I feel like I've read some of the big ones, and I've read Tortilla Flat, Cannery Row, all those. And so now I'm excited to wander into the lesser known. So what would you say the most underrated is? Is it also To a God Unknown, you think?
Yeah. I think the most underrated is probably The Moon is Down.
Okay.
It's one of those short novels that also could function very well and I think has as a play. So maybe a novelette about a town that's under siege from a fascist regime. It was written during World War II. It was written, I don't know that the term propaganda is necessarily that useful when we're talking about narrative fiction, because there's a wholeness to the characters in that book. But it was definitely written as part of the war effort. Steinbeck did not enlist, though he did embed with a couple different groups during World War II and then again during Vietnam. So I think he thinks of this as one of his like wartime contributions. And in fact, it was translated into multiple languages by members of the resistance and circulated throughout Europe. And
I see.
Handwritten on like onion paper, and owning a copy could be a death sentence. So I think that we just don't talk about him in terms of that and in terms of the role of the material relationship between that book and the war effort in World War II in Europe, the resistance.
Do you think I made a mistake in my year of reading through Steinbeck by skipping Cup of Gold? Should I go back at a certain point, you think?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I haven't read Cup of Gold.
Okay, yeah. See, it just based on my perspective, it seems like Pastures of Heaven is the starting point and then making your way through. And that book just seemed so out of left field and experimental that it just didn't feel like it was necessary for me to go there. But I've heard different opinions from different people.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead.
Sorry. I'd just be curious to hear the case for it. But yeah, it felt similar to me.
Okay. Where did your interest in Steinbeck come from?
Yeah, I've been interested in Steinbeck as long as I can remember. He's one of my dad's favorite authors. I was born in Mountain View and come from a family that my dad's dad came out to the South Bay or the San Jose area to work at, Lockheed back in the day. So I feel like there's a sort of biographical connection there. But I also, to me, he's just always felt like the standard for fiction that balances intellectual engagement and kind of the whole person in terms of emotional resonance.
Okay. How has the scholarly discourse in the aggregate evolved over your time studying Steinbeck? I know that there's peaks and valleys with a lot of artists where there'll be high levels of interest and then those will kind of dissipate over time. So where are we at in scholarly interest in Steinbeck's writing?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. There was definitely, a bit of a backlash in the following his death for a couple decades, the sense from in the 70s and 80s that he was not literary. But in fact, that wasn't terribly new in his life. His last novel, Winter of Our Discontent, was panned. Travels with Charlie got good reviews, some, and then critical reviews, and then some people retracted their good reviews. So I think following Grapes of Wrath, like he had a fraught relationship with public sentiment. That being said, I think he is our most popular and most widely read and most widely taught American author, and especially California author. And so, in that sense, I think he has an enduring interest among the readership and an ongoing sort of ambivalent interest with scholarship. There are dedicated Steinbeck scholars, and there's a really vibrant society of folks working on Steinbeck. Yeah. I also think that the legal wrangling around the film rights in the aughts into the teens, like, shape the landscape of public interest too. So we have that new Netflix series that's going to be coming out from Tracy Letts and Florence Pugh attached. Like, I think that's going to re we're going to see a revival of interest. Oprah did get a large swath of America to reread East of Eden, so I think he's doing just fine.
Okay, fantastic. Do you think at some point Wallace Stegner will take over the mantle from Steinbeck in California in terms of fiction, or do you think Steinbeck will retain his seat as preeminent?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have a feeling Steinbeck will retain his seat, especially as the ways that we think about literature and approach it change. I think Steinbeck, in some ways, keeps up with the times a little bit more. He has a fraught relationship to representing women, especially after his divorce with Carol in the early 1940s.
Yeah, we'll come to some questions about how women are portrayed in this book for sure. I want to ask you about your writing before we jump into the book. I enjoyed reading about pedagogy and Steinbeck. How do students, college students, engage with Steinbeck today? What do they like and what do they dislike about his writing?
Yeah, I taught a Steinbeck class 2 years ago at SJSU, and I think I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I was impressed by how engaged students were with them. I think, like me, to be honest, coming into the directorship of the Steinbeck Center, there's the Steinbeck I knew, and then there's just like all this other stuff, right? I think he's a pioneer of creative nonfiction in ways that, since he wasn't part of the new journalism movement, get missed. Students like that, we read the Russian Journal, they were really interested in it. Yeah. A deep love of Grapes of Wrath came out. And then also, I found that a lot of students of faith have different ways into his novels than I do, but that still has an ongoing resonance for students. And this is, I teach at San Jose State, so it's not, my classes are, we're like a minority majority institution. And so it's not just like white kids loving Steinbeck, but I think he's got a lot to say to us all. And I think part of it is learning to approach him the way we would Dickens, like warts and all, where we don't have to be reverent in order to be engaged.
Do you think those kids that are coming to your class from the Central Valley or from rural agricultural regions are going to engage with Steinbeck differently?
Yeah, and I think they do, but I also think we have to bring other texts into view. So, like, we read all of the Harvest Gypsies essays, right? We read In Dubious Battle. So we were engaging a lot with kind of histories of agriculture in California. But as you may have seen from my article on To a God Unknown, I'm really interested in reading the book in context, and including context the author may not have been aware of, right? Or things that might illuminate some horizons of his perception. And I think for my students of color, reading Steinbeck's essays about how immigrant laborers in California are, I don't know, he had some strange ideas about the future of Filipino Americans in California, especially because the government had passed an act that allowed them to, that was trying to, I don't know, maybe an early iteration of self-deportation, and Steinbeck thought that would take hold. I think we read them differently.
Okay, let's talk about your article, The Land Doesn't Stretch. I really enjoyed it, and I have a number of questions about it. I love the first sentence, which is basically saying, To a God Unknown is known as odd and beautiful. Why do you think the beautiful is less featured in writing about it, and the emphasis tends to be on the odd? Is it the difference that causes people to overlook the aesthetic beauty present in the work? Do you think that's what it is?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I grew up really loving a lot of kind of weird fiction. And so To a God Unknown really resonates to me with someone like, I don't know, Amy Bender or something, these sorts of weird genre play, but dislocated in time from that entire movement and production. So I think some of it is certainly the representations of sexuality are cartoonish or exaggerated, hyperbolic. But I actually find like purpose in all of that. But I think that can be off-putting. The book starts more or less with Joseph arriving at the valley and humping the ground. And so that's when you think about, for me at least, thinking about like, how do we import this book into classrooms? Because I think that it has a lot to, in California, we don't really reckon with drought intellectually in a long-term way. It's very much a sort of reaction cycle. And I think the book has a lot to offer there. But I think, yeah, people struggle with some of the sexuality stuff. I also think it could use a good sanding down at the end, you know?
Absolutely. Well, let's jump into drought because that was my next question. This book takes place or is produced during periods of drought, but it's also produced during the Dust Bowl. And so that features really prominently here. But when I read it initially, my brain went to the religious interpretation. I was looking at institutional religion versus animistic religion versus these kind of dimensions of panentheism, like God in earth. And so I didn't, because that was so prominent and so explicit, I didn't approach it from an agricultural lens. What's the case that that should feature more prominently in how I view this novel and not just purely as like a text about religious syncretism and spirituality?
Yeah, I think the religious syncretism and spirituality comes from those salons with biologist Ed Ricketts and Carol Henning and Joseph Campbell came through the salons. I think the agriculture, to me, I bring that as a sort of forward lens for the text, in part because that's what Steinbeck knew, right? Like growing up in Salinas in a farming town, I also working at the Spreckels factory, I think that and seeing the institutional power that farm owners wielded, as well as what happened when they went bankrupt. And in California, every time there's a major drought in farm country, we see a swath of bankruptcies and the consolidation of land. And so that was really on my mind. Also, the emergence of groundwater pumping technology was brand new. And so that was what I was thinking about it. Again, to go back to the cartoonish sort of sexuality or reproduction play, I think that's why all the stuff with the bulls is that it's supposed to be perverse, it's supposed to be outsized. Yeah. In terms of religion, at least my approach to it, I think there's definitely a sort of pantheist syncretism going on. But I also think Steinbeck romanticizes indigenous cosmology and is reaching for what he believes to be something beyond, either in some kind of ground where he can touch a sense of like spiritual connection with the land in ways that are parallel to or intersect with indigenous, like his idea of native or indigenous spirituality. And I don't know, I find the spirituality question a bit fraught because when Joseph is having all of his kind of world brain hallucinations, he's doing it in a site that native women historically went to during birth. And I think there's something there that I don't know. I don't really know what to do with beyond a realm of sort of fantasy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Something that you mentioned in your article, but was also coming to mind when I was reading it, was the interplay between Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier hypothesis and To a God Unknown. How do they speak to each other if you were to describe that, if it was a conversation between this book and that theory of the development of the United States? How are they talking?
Yeah, I think Turner's theory was, I think, a distillation of a popular sentiment at the same time that he's crafting a new kind of container for it. But I think this idea of sort of frontierism giving way to a sort of domesticated frontier giving way to industry is like something that we just see, especially in California. Steinbeck is living through kind of the industrialization of agricultural regions, that sort of second to third stage. And to be honest, I find in when I write about the novel in my book, there's a bit more kind of theory engaged, and I'm reading in a different context. So when I thought about writing it for the Steinbeck Review and approaching it in my teaching, I find Turner's thesis and Gas Image is like a really easy, like straightforward frame to bring to the book that does reflect its structure, right? Being that Joseph's Elizabeth to marriage marks the end of a first stage of the book. Elizabeth's death ushers in a third stage. And I think reading in those ways, it takes some of the messiness and helped me think through the different phases of life on the ranch. Also, it was originally envisioned as an intergenerational family drama. And so I think some of those joints that I'm noticing are maybe left over from earlier drafts as it's
I
moving
see.
between different parts of the family.
The other thing you talk about in your article is the concept of time. Time feels strange here. It almost feels, to use the Greek terms like chronos and kairos, you have our atomic clock time, but then there's this other time, this kairos time, where it's like God is peeking through time and pointing to moments as important or something. So how do you think Steinbeck structures time in this novel?
Yeah, I think that I like that. I think that there's a struggle between sort of the domestic time of the family farm, right? Like births and deaths, that kind of thing, and Joseph's development as a sort of patriarch. And then I think when Steinbeck's writing the world brain or these hallucinogenic moments, I don't know, I can't help wondering, like growing up by the mountains, or if that was just something that sort of sense of geologic time was on his mind. And that maybe perhaps that's the God peeking through.
Yeah. And then I love this concept that you talk about in the article of gendering space. And we've already referenced pumping of ground. And so are we to see landscape as feminine energy? Or like, how is Steinbeck looking at landscape? And how is he gendering space in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think that his sense of the ways that human life and the environment are reflected off of each other in this novel, it tends to be pretty essentialist, right? Like Joseph is represented by a giant tree. Elizabeth is represented by or connected to a glade that you have to break into. And there's like a rock with a stream coming out, like the physical metaphor, or that moment of the marriage where he compares them entering the valley to conception, right? I think that there's, in some ways, again, to go back to the exaggeration of the physical, I think that's part of what's showing up there. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
I think so. Help me with this. I struggle with this. I've read a number of eco-criticism of the novel, and I think there's, and maybe this is just my more traditional historical approach to work, I have a hard time feeling like I'm reading something into something. But like you said before, sometimes authors, we distinguish between artist and art, the creator and the product. But I have a hard time. At what cognizant level do you think he was engaged in some kind of environmental or eco-criticism in this work? And how much is that like our current priorities reading into this work?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Environmental entanglement is such a key part of Steinbeck's just worldview.
Yeah.
I think growing up on a farm connected to animals, if you're going to read The Long Valley and those stories and get to the Red Pony, like there's a visceral kind of autobiographical connection or sense of environmental entanglement that comes through. In terms of, yeah, maybe the utility of reading environmentally from the book, or whether or not we're reaching backward for something that wasn't there, I don't know. I mean, I think that he was pretty embedded in a heavily, like I've said, agricultural region. And I think there are elements of, this is just my approach in general. I tend to think with Raymond Williams and structures of feeling when I'm thinking about the act of historical criticism, is that how do we try to reconstruct for ourselves our understanding of the world the authors lived in, so that we can understand both what they were consciously focused on and what evaded their perception or what was there at the fringes. And I think there's a stunning absence of consideration of the environment as a structuring factor in literature and in human life in general. And I think some eco-criticism as a project comes in some ways out of nature writing and has been fighting with itself for about 35 years about what its purpose is and whether or not it's about beauty or about like cognition, climate change, extinction, all those things. When we come to Steinbeck's writing about the environment, I just think he was one of the few people who attempted to write about the environment in a really clear-eyed way. Eugenics was also a big vehicle that shaped a lot of public, especially white folks, public perceptions about the environment, both in the US and in California, which was like a big player in that movement, or had some of big players in that movement. Yeah. And so for Steinbeck, humans are decentered in a lot of interactions. And I think Thomas is a really beautiful place that comes through, or where that comes through in the novel, that we can see that the environment is meant to be central.
How do you think Steinbeck would engage with deep ecology, this kind of concept that humans can be parasitical, or that nature, that we need to think about, yeah, decentered humans in that realm? Do you think he would recognize himself in those theories, or do you think he would have points of difference? Because there is a lot of humanism that I see in Steinbeck as well. And so I'm curious what you think, how you think you'd engage with that particular set of theories.
Yeah. Richard Astro wrote the first and hallmark book on Steinbeck's relationship to the biologist Ed Ricketts. And a lot of times their kind of environmental thinking gets conflated. But I think one of the differences between them is Ricketts, who's a marine biologist, really believed in or really advocated for something they both tended to call non-teleological thinking, right? Just is thinking. And so I think for Ricketts, there was more meaning within the somewhat random or not metaphysically structured kind of nature of reality. Steinbeck is a humanist and is someone who I think was just always heart forward. He has a different view of that. But I think that he looks to the natural world as a source of truths in understanding human behavior in ways, I don't know. Yeah. I wouldn't say that he's not anthropocentric, but I also don't think that's necessarily very useful. In terms of deep ecology, I think there's a lot that he would take from it. I also think, though, that he was engaged with it before we had a term for it. Same way he was engaged with like environmental justice before we had a term for it. And within his own kind of perceptual limitations, now we couldn't talk about environmental justice without talking about like race or gender. But at his time, he was really concerned about how the land functioned as a, or environment functioned as like a mediator of inequality.
Oftentimes in political activist groups, they pick up a novel or pick up a piece of art that can guide. Do you think this novel has legs for like climate activists, or do you think it will get bogged down in all the weirdness and some of the gender issues in this work? Do you think it could be a text that becomes that re gets revived for the moment that we're in?
I'd be curious. I think so. I think there's a lot more to do with this text than has been done, and it is going to enter the public domain in the next decade. So I think to what I said about sanding down the end, like there are ways in which I'd be curious to see either film or TV show adaptation, which I think are probably unlikely. I think a graphic novel adaptation could do really beautiful work.
This was originally for the theater in some ways. Is this something that's theatrical? That could be a really strange Broadway musical, maybe.
I always thought the werewolf novel would make a bizarre and great Broadway musical. There have been stage, like you said, that came out of a play. There have been stage adaptations of To a God Unknown. We have one in the center. Someone did their, I think, a thesis or a diss that was like adapting it into a musical. So it's happened. It'll probably happen again.
I would love a double feature of To a God Unknown and the Book of Mormon. I think that would be an incredible night at the
There you
theater.
go.
Let's talk about religion now. This is centers pretty clearly in the book. How should we understand what Steinbeck is doing with religion here? Is this a lot of experimentation, exploration? I know he's got the Jungian stuff going on with the archetypes and how he paints characters. Like, how should we look at the universe of religion in this particular novel?
Yeah, it's, I think two things come to mind for me when I'm thinking about this. The first, of course, is Burton, and that's the clearest, right? And Burton's censure of Steinbeck's sort of pantheistic impulses, his relationship to the tree. There's like a way of reading the novel that Joseph Swain's father's ghost floats across North America, inhabits the tree, and Joseph has this magical relationship where he's like asking for protection, putting the baby in the tree's arms. And so I think Joseph, as we've said, is the sort of pantheistic, idiosyncratic spirituality. Burton is, I think, Calvinist and far more structured, right? We get his first censure when Joseph is very excited to try to watch the cows mate and is wanting more cows. And Burton is, that's a bit strange.
How should we? Because obviously, as someone with a background in religious studies, I was reading early books of the Hebrew Bible here in my mind as much as I was reading Steinbeck. Like, how should we look at the pretty like heavy-handed allusions to the biblical story of Joseph? Is that something we should like use as an interpretive tool, or is that too facile and too he's maybe use maybe that's a tool that he's using, but it's not shouldn't be our primary focus.
Yeah, I tend to be pretty agnostic when it comes to which tools we should be using. I think there are many ways up the mountain. My guess is that you probably have a deeper reading of that than I do from the book, because I don't have a, I was raised Lutheran, but it's not something that I've kept up with. And I don't have a, I don't tend to move to kind of biblical analysis much in literature. It's just not where I move from. Yeah, what do you think though?
Yeah, I think it's there is a John Winthrop City on the Hill, but City Betrayed going on. So I think there's an element of manifest destiny mixed through the story of Joseph saving a people and finding a new homeland. And so there's a lot of allusions, but I don't really have a concrete kind of interpretive framework for how those allusions contribute meaning. It's just more, it's putting these things in my brain that I'm tossing around, and I don't like the paint by number, like this means this. I think it's more just like layers of meaning added and stacked. And almost at a point got overwhelming for me just seeing all these allusions. And I was like, I feel like this is distracting me in some ways from engaging with the text, if that makes sense.
It totally does. And that, to be honest, is the way that I tend to feel about the white-bearded guy at the end with his ritual to the sun. I really, both Steinbeck and his wife Carol came from homes that were religious. Different scholars and biographers have different feelings about, or different stances on Steinbeck's feelings about religion throughout his life. It was complicated and it shifted. I know that Carol came from a stricter, more religious family. And they both, I think, during the period of the writing of the novel, they were young. They were bohemian. They wanted something, they wanted a different order of thinking or a different arena for thinking. And so I think that's the way I read the Burton scene, as I can't help reading it as a reflection of a sense of like social judgment or the family conflicts that arise from that desire to know through a different framework.
Let's talk about characters. Some of them feel really flat to me. Archetypes. How should we look at these from a literary perspective?
This is also where I think about the fact that the novel was originally imagined to be multi-generational, and then there was a lot of collapsing.
Yeah,
So I
can you
think.
talk about the fusion of Joseph, of two characters into one character? And does that contribute to the flatness in some ways?
I wonder. I mean, in terms of the character's flatness, I think I maybe have less to offer there. But I do think that he had this whole cast in mind. And I think California's 19th century history, its rancho economy did blend sort of labor and family and kinship obligations, right? And so I think there's a way in which he wanted that kind of broadcast. It also feels to me like we have archetypes because maybe these characters, some of them feel like they were supposed to do things that never ended up happening. And then some of them, like I actually find Juanito to be the most fascinating character of the book. We know he's got mixed heritage, though he denies his native heritage. That comes up sometimes later. He's the one at the end of the novel, right? When Joseph's all alone and is contemplating his mortality, Juanito's the one who finds him, takes him home, puts him into bed, feeds him a meal, and has this interesting reflection, or interesting to me, about he thinks about trickster gods and the ways that like birds can fly into the chapel and shit on Saint Joseph's head during a sermon. And so there's an undecidability to Juanito that I think is interesting. And I don't know. I don't know that I would say that he's necessarily even a round character so much as just like stuff gets layered on top of him.
How should we look at that scene after the murder of Benji and like Joseph and Juanito's interaction? That was confusing for me as a reader. I was trying to think about what am I learning about these characters through this interaction? Like, how did you interpret that particular scene? And that it feels like it's a hinge point in the novel in many ways. How do you look at it?
Thinking about it, I haven't thought about it terribly much. Thinking about it now, I almost feel like there's a way in which Juanito needs to disappear from the narrative and come back because he's got this access to this longer knowledge about the land and a different register for thinking of it. But we're also moving from the early stage of the novel, which is more frontiery, right? Where Juanito's like an unpaid laborer who's living on the ranch. It feels very, I don't know, cowboy and ethnic sidekick to me. And he's disappeared from the narrative when Elizabeth arrives because Joseph is moving from a sort of frontier stage into a more domesticated stage, maybe. Also, I think Benji was just like, sometimes with young writers, rather than having motivations and actions that attempt to bring them closer to the motivations but cause conflict, we just have like things that happen because it seemed like plot. And that's the way, Benji's kind of plot line feels a little bit to me, is it's something that's happening, you know?
I felt the same way. Another character that kind of confused me, and I was thinking through what her role in Joseph's spiritual journey was, Rama. How should we think about Rama? And then maybe you can use this as a point of departure to talk about how women are portrayed more broadly in this novel.
It's hard. I feel like Rama's both meant to be this feminine archetype, right? Like she's capable of helping Elizabeth give birth and then goes and cooks dinner afterward, right? So there is a way in which her feminine role is very conventional, but I also think it's aiming toward what might have felt like a kind of deeper monomythic sense of feminine authority. The same way that Joseph is the patriarch of the ranch, Elizabeth never becomes like a matriarch. Instead, I think Rama continues to occupy that role, such that at the end of the novel, she has to take the kid. Or she and Thomas take John Jr., right, who's named after the dead grandpa's ghost, with them across to the San Joaquin Valley. I don't know. I think that Rama is meant to be the sort of central kind of figure in that way.
Yeah. And more broadly, women portrayed in this novel, we were talking about flatness of characters. There's some dimension of I want more from Elizabeth. I want more from some of the women characters. How have scholars looked at this book in terms of, I remember I was looking around for kind of some feminist critiques of this novel. I wasn't finding very much. But how do you think, using that particular lens, how do you think we should look at this novel?
Yeah, this is maybe a personal perspective and maybe not a popular one, but I think there's definitely a scholarly sense of kind of the question of gender in Steinbeck's work that's been addressed. I think much Steinbeck scholarship, because he's been ignored, or some might say neglected, by kind of highbrow literary studies, Steinbeck studies tends to have, I don't know. I think there's a tendency to think about protecting the author and not, or what is and isn't a fair kind of line of critique. Susan Schillinglaw's book on Carol and John's marriage is excellent, but I don't think that we've seen as much of a formal feminist critique of Steinbeck's work, because I don't know that there's the appetite for it among Steinbeck scholarship in the same way. For me, the ways that I see both, I would say, women and gender represented in the novel, certainly there's a sense of, I don't know, like this metaphysical patriarchal authority through connection to the land and lineage. That's very obvious. What was I going to say in terms of, oh, but I also think that's in so much of Steinbeck's early fiction, and I think best work with women characters, that's troubled the whole way through. And I think part of that is because Carol was such an active editorial partner in the development of Steinbeck's work, maybe more, certainly more so on Grapes of Wrath than something like To a God Unknown, which would have been much earlier in their relationship. But for example, when they're going through the pass and there's that, like, the sperm and the egg sort of monologue, there's this moment where just like Elizabeth is reflecting on a kind of death that she's going to have to undergo in the marriage. She reflects that it's a bitter thing to be a woman. So I think that feels very real to me. And I think there's something of Carol that's coming through there. We also know that Carol probably had an emotional affair with Joseph Campbell. They were bohemians, so who, I think the idea of a strict monogamy to their marriage is maybe a little anachronistic to their experience of the times. But she certainly is thought to have had a deep emotional affair with Campbell that he reflected on even at the end of his life. And so I think Elizabeth dying, I wouldn't say that it's like a literary punishment, but I also think there's maybe some catharsis happening there.
Which another kind of religious lens, I'm just keep going back to the religious lens, but
Please.
another thing that came to my mind when I was reading was Elizabeth is a school teacher and she's got this book knowledge, and that's, I'm thinking about the tree of knowledge, I'm thinking about Adam and Eve, and that's coming to front of mind here. But what is he, is Steinbeck saying something about academic or book knowledge in attaching that to Elizabeth, and she lets that world go as she goes to be with him on the farm, essentially?
Yeah, I think maybe. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Certainly, I think that for women, marriage during that time period, for women of with middle class aspirations, it would be very difficult to think about staying in a marriage or entering into a marriage and continuing to work. I think one of the things about Elizabeth to me too is that she becomes obsessed with the glade and the rock, right? In ways that, yeah, feel like I think they're meant to be a sort of a pre-verbal sort of attachment or entanglement, right? Because when she goes out to it and has this vision of the waters in the Pacific and the child inside of her, there's something there that I think is meant to be, stands in contrast maybe to the kind of book learning that she would have done as a school teacher.
Okay. Let's take a 20,000 foot perspective here. Let's imagine Steinbeck continues to write like this. What does his career look like?
Oh, goodness. I think we would get a lot more supernatural elements. both this and the werewolf novel. This one at least got published, but it was market failure. The werewolf novel never got published. He was always interested in kind of supernatural themes in his work, but I think if he continued to write like this, we would have seen something weirder.
I love all of his later work that is more kind of realist and more, but this is interesting in ways. And I wonder, because you're right, from what I've read, it was a total failure, but I'm reading now Tortilla Flat because I'm going on to the next work now. And it just doesn't feel as fun as this is in some way. So now that I'm engaging with the next text, Tortilla Flat, Canary Row, you know, those books, I love the kind of wild characters and all the things, but there is something really bold in this work. Why do you think it was a failure in the marketplace at that time? Was it just too much for people? Was it too out in left field? Were people not ready? Did it just not make sense to people? What do you speculate?
Yeah, I think the structural stuff that we've talked about was definitely part of it. I also think it comes out into a market that's where Hemingway is, as people have said, moved the furniture, right, of literature in the US. It's like very much an apolitical novel, which I think is why it's so interesting to read politically in some ways. Yeah. I wonder, I think it's just the weirdness.
That's great. I love weird stuff. I have been doing a little Samuel Delaney rereading re recently.
Nice.
One of my favorites. I love stuff that it's just you don't ex you, you you can't anticipate what the next page will give you. And but I think commercial success and that tend to be not correlated. So, which makes
Yeah.
sense. Let me ask you some broad questions about going forward because we're going to continue reading. The next book we're coming to is Tortilla Flat. Are there certain things that we should carry with us from these first two books, Pastures of Heaven and To a God Unknown, that will inform our later reading? Or do you feel like this is a kind of pivot point where we're entering a new kind of voice that maybe is disconnected in some ways from these early works?
Yeah, that's a great question. I tend to think, for example, that To a God Unknown recourses to, or I would, shouldn't say recourse, because I don't think it's a weakness. I'd say that To a God Unknown engages with the supernatural and the unreal and these sort of watercolor shapes of characters and actions the way it does, because he's just so young, right? I think also just as a person, he's continuing to mature and he's also turning the corner toward a more material engaged sense of research, right? And by the time we get to Of Mice and Men and Grapes of Wrath, he's modeling. I know there are critiques of his research methods, and there should be for any kind of established author, but I think he's modeling a form of engagement with material circumstances, by which I mean money and then all in politics, but also just like people and their living stories throughout the 30s. That muscle grows with each book. And so I think that's something to keep an eye out for, especially because Tortilla Flat ends up sparking all of this tourism. And so the relationship between real places and the stories is more firmly grounded in reality than maybe the Apprentice novels like Cup of Gold or To a God Unknown.
This is a history podcast, but this is an education podcast as well. And I want to equip people with tools to enhance their reading experience. So if you're looking at secondary literature and for someone that's just wanting to read through Steinbeck, what are some things you'd point to that would be helpful for people? It doesn't have to be purely just academic articles. It could be resources, documentaries. Are there certain things that would enhance it that don't cloud your ability to read the text, but enhance it in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. It's dry and boring, so maybe more for lecture material. But I would say The Conquest of Bread, Richard Walker's History of Agribusiness in California is great. For a lay reader, someone who's just interested in general, I think it's easy to get intimidated by Steinbeck, A Life in Letters, and the Jack Benson biography because they're both so big. But I also think they're both really well constructed as resources, so you can dive in and out. So I think in terms of understanding some more context of his writing, the letters are just fascinating, right? It's like Mice and Men in part is so short because the dog ate the first draft. And like scraps of that first draft from the dog sell for
I
on.
think there's a few writers that would benefit by the dog eating their first draft. My partner was reading through that new dragon fantasy thing that's taking over the world, and she was like, that was about 200 pages too long.
Yeah.
So I think some concision would be helpful for some writers. So for you, what is the best biography?
Oh, I'm not going to weigh into that minefield. But I will
Okay.
say the Steinbeck
Well, is
Review.
maybe categorize the biography. So go to this for this, go to this for this.
Yeah. So actually, the Steinbeck Review recently had an article from Barbara Hevlin and Chuck Etheridge that does a review of all the biographies.
Oh,
That's,
fantastic.
yeah.
Okay.
But I would say Susan's biography, Susan Schillinglaw, is one of my favorite. I think she gives such a compelling portrait of the marriage, and Carol is just like such a fascinating character to reckon with.
Yeah.
A lot of Steinbeck Studies folks feel skeptical about the new Souter biography, Mad at the World. I really liked it. And then people have different feelings about the Jay Perini biography from the 90s. It's a little bit more literary, a little bit more public facing. I think it's probably a great starting point. I also think Souter is a good starting point, but others would disagree with me on that.
Okay. If people liked To a God Unknown, what other novel of Steinbeck most resembles it? So if they want to just skip my kind of chronological order and they're like, "Ooh, this was the book for me." What's the next one they should jump to?
Yeah, the one most liked To a God Unknown.
Or the most clear path from To a God Unknown to it? Is it just Tortilla Flat or would you jump ahead?
Yeah, I actually, when I taught, we went from this to In Dubious Battle. And I like that because In Dubious Battle is about a strike in a valley in California. And narratively, I think that novel is just like, it's got incredible momentum and clear characters. There's a, yeah, I would say that's an interesting counterpoint because we go from thinking about kind of agriculture and history through a metaphysical lens into a very material, practical, like, union organizing lens that is more of a potboiler in terms of action. Like it pulls back the arrow and it just goes. So I think those are really interesting to read together.
Okay, let's imagine you're in a room with a bunch of university faculty. They're teaching American literature courses, and your job is to make the case why they should include To a God Unknown in their course reading list. What would be the case to include it versus they would say, why shouldn't we just read Grapes of Wrath or East of Eden, these kind of tomes that have this sterling reputation and people would come back to them again and again. What would be your case to them to try to read this in their undergrad courses?
Yeah, in my experience, students really respond to it. And then friends of mine who've taught it have had the same. I think now at this point, historically, we have a toolkit to take something like the sort of cartoonish representations of sexuality or maybe patriarchy, right? Or like gendered relationships to the landscape. We've got all that vocabulary just in the water now. So you can use it to elevate your kind of reading of what are in some ways some of the weirder elements of the book. Which isn't to say that's the only way to interpret them. And students don't take that one-to-one, even students who read my article, though they did it after we read the novel. Yeah, I think there's that. And I think just call it what it is. I think so often, I think this novel probably wasn't taught because we didn't know how to talk in some ways about some of the cartoonish sexuality. So, oh, that's too obvious, too directly in focus, and weird. Whereas now we can just be like, yeah, why is that weird? That's a great place to put a little pressure and see what happens.
Yeah,
And
you'll probably have very interesting discussions in class with this novel, which, if there's anything to get those kids off their laptops and their phones, some cartoonist sexuality might draw them out of their siloed existence. All right, so we close these podcasts in the same place every time, which is with book recommendations. These can be Steinbeck books. I know we mentioned a number of the biographies, but I'm sure you have some other recommendations for people beyond what you've already listed.
yeah, secondary material on Steinbeck or just.
Yeah, just anything really. Anything that would enhance either people's understanding of California history and Steinbeck's time, Steinbeck in general, or what he's doing literarily in a lot of this stuff. Like, what are some recommendations you have?
Yeah, I think Carlos Boulosson's America's in the Heart is a really interesting pairing with any of Steinbeck's 1930s novels. That is an autobiographical novel from a Filipino American writer, starts when he's born in the Philippines, I think in Luzon, and travels to the US and then is in Alaska and is actively engaging in union organizing of farm workers. And it goes through dance halls and police raids and vigilante violence. And I think it's a little bit more hard-nosed and a little bit, in some ways, angrier, right, than Steinbeck's work because Son was encountering direct violence. But I think they pair really interestingly. So I would say that's a great one to read alongside Steinbeck.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'll just leave it there.
Okay, perfect. To close, what are you working on next and what's going on at the Steinbeck Center?
Yeah, I'm finishing out my 4-year term at the Steinbeck Center. So Nick Taylor, the previous director, is going to jump in interim as I get ready to try to apply for a sabbatical. But there's some really great stuff going on. We have a special issue on race and ethnicity that's coming out at the Steinbeck Review. If you go to steinbeck.com, you can find all of our resources, including the Steinbeck and the Schools website, which was just revamped. It's beautiful. It's worth taking a look. It's got resources for casual readers, and if you're a teacher, like great educational resources. And the other thing I would plug is that next spring at Arizona State University in Tempe, and I think the second or third week of March, I think it's the second, we'll have the International Steinbeck Society Conference. And that's always a blast. The keynotes are going to be Barbara Hevlin, the editor-in-chief of Steinbeck Review, and Susan Schillinglaw around their recent book on Travels with Charlie. But it should be a really great event. So I think those are some things that if you want to get involved, there's that, and then we always have calls for papers at other conferences like American Literature or Western Lit Association.
Dr. Rivers, this has been a lot of fun, and I feel like I have a lot more clarity about this complex book than when we started. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and helping to elucidate some of the more complicated aspects of this fascinating little book.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a fun conversation.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.